everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Speakeasy Podcast. My name is Kate.
And I'm Alan.
We run ReverseThieves.com, an anime and manga blog and podcast site, where you can get 3+ blog posts every week, as well as various other podcasts, including our seasonal SWAT reviews, where we look at the first episode of a bunch of new shows of the season. And of course, you can get all the old episodes of the monthly Speakeasy Podcast there as well.
And if you have any questions or comments or show topics, please email them to us at ReverseThieves@gmail.com or contact us on Twitter. I'm HisuiRT.
And I'm NarutakiRT.
And if you like this podcast or any other thing that we do, please leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps us go up in the ranks and contact new listeners. Let's check in with what's new on the blog this month.
My manga of the month is Tokyo Tarareba Girls, and I picked this mostly because there's a very minor point of the plot of this story is that this woman wants to get married before the Tokyo 2020 Olympics, and since it's the Olympics right now, it made me think of it, so that's sort of my takeoff point for why I chose it for the month.
Makes sense. Have they mentioned anything about the 2018, or what's released not that far?
Oh, the manga's finished.
Oh, okay.
So.
Okay, cool. You too can join the people throwing shade at us by listening to our two podcasts about the ending of Precure a la Mode and the beginning of the new season of Precure, Hugto Precure.
It's been very interesting that a lot of bitter people have just suddenly found our blog/podcast. I don't know why. That's just a weird coincidence.
Learn how our Precure tastes are basic. I should finally get around to reviewing the Fate's Day Night Heaven's Feel first movie, Presage Flower. Or Presage, I should say. Presage Flower. Ongoing investigations. What we've been reading, watching, and playing. So, Kate, I hear you've dipped back into the meat grinder.
Oh my god, like, I know. Don't you kind of feel sad for weekly Shonen Jump starts in America? Of course, in Japan they get... I feel as though we pretty much get them all at this point, so they're not even really getting to try anything that we aren't, but it feels as though they have power over them, whereas we don't have any.
Yeah, it would be curious to see if there were any that, like, really hit it off with American audiences that, like, Japanese audiences were like, P.U.
Yeah, I mean, I can't tell. And the two that are still running from the last time they did this are Robot X Laserbeam and that one about the two dumb girls that need to be tutored. That's a pervy one. That one. I mean, it's got fan service, so that one is, I guess, not surprising.
Hey man, Two Love Ru ran like forever.
That's what I'm saying. And no, it's gone now, so.
And that was never on strength of plot.
Yeah, so I'm saying I'm not surprised that one has survived.
Oh yeah, no.
So we got two this kind of time around. Bo's Beats is sort of this monks plus heavy artillery magic kind of a series. And I thought it started off pretty okay because it's this really grizzled monk going into the forest and the forest is having some like weird supernatural activity and he starts talking to the wolves in the forest and then there's this kid who's being raised by the wolves and that seems as though that kid's sort of going to be like his apprentice or has some ability or whatever. But then 3/4 of the way through of the, this is the first chapter, the wolf mom dies, so no, minus 500 points. And then it has a time jump, and then this kid who was living in the woods is now a monk apprentice, and he's in the regular world. I was like, no, can we go back to the forest child story? That seems better. So I was like, eh. And then, you know, monks with guns. That's just not me. I don't know. That's nothing really. I felt like when it was more about kid being raised by wolves in the forest, that was like the better hook.
How is the kid when he's grown up or of what you see of him?
Kind of shonen pro tag.
So actually, we've been recently having this long discussion.
I know.
About, like, the generic shonen protagonist. And,
you know, he basically ends the manga by being like, I'm gonna be the best or whatever, so...
I'm going to be the very best.
Yeah, so
like
no it's not...
one ever was.
I mean, the art was really good, mm-hmm. and I feel like maybe people will like the guns aspect of it.
I feel like I want to talk a little about the discussion we had when we were running this weekend, which was, you know, you had this whole question about, like, the generic shonen dude, the shonen stereotype. And I thought, you know, it was an interesting question of all the, like, standout shonen heroes are not what you immediately think of with generic shonen hero. Why do we have that archetype in our head?
Besides Naruto.
Mm-hmm.
And I also wonder if it's easier to chase mediocrity than it is to be, oh, well, I'm going to be the standout. It's just easier to be in the middle than...
Plus, I mean, there are, like, dozens and dozens of moderately successful shonen series that we don't think about, and just kind of, how much does Mar Elemental Hero ever enter your head except for the fact that I just mentioned it now?
Right. I guess I just want people to aspire to higher, you know what I mean? It's just, mm-hmm. why are you, if you want to copy something, why not copy the best as opposed to just the ones that are in the middle?
And
maybe it's just hard to write those good characters. I mean, obviously it's hard to write good characters. Otherwise, we would all do it and every manga would be great, etc., etc. So, I mean, I get it. But if you're going to emulate someone, I find it interesting.
No. I just thought it was an interesting discussion. It immediately popped in my head that you just mentioned. Yeah, he's just kind of, you know, generico protagonist by the end of the first chapter.
Like I said, I feel as though they immediately take away the one thing that was interesting about him, which was this growing up in this environment and kind of being a part of that nature. And so that's gone. So not interesting anymore, basically.
Do you think that it could, I mean, because it basically time skips most, only like really time skips at the end. Do you think that maybe he might be like, you know, everybody else is from, you know, prim and proper civilization, and he is the kind of the wild man, you know, the classic raised by wolves kid, and thereby different from everybody? Or do you think that, like, they've whitewashed a lot of that away by the end?
It's hard to tell, I would say, from the end of the first chapter. But the end of the first chapter, he's meeting, like, another character around his age, and is like, this guy's gonna be, like, your partner, or, like, the person you train with, or whatever. And you know, it's sort of like, great.
No, I was just, it just popped into my head. You usually have a good instinct for these things, so I'm not doubting you. I was just like, I'm just, like, trying to throw this manga a lifeline.
We'll see if it catches on, but I didn't feel as though it had a lot of potential.
That's fair.
The other one was Act Age, which was a very unexpected manga, in my mind, mm-hmm. for Weekly Shonen Jump, because it's basically Glass Mask. Because it's like this girl who wants to be an actress, and I don't remember what happened to her parents. I don't know if they died or they abandoned the family, and she has younger siblings that she's trying to take care of. So she's doing these odd jobs and she wants to become an actress, but she's like, well, if I can't do it, then I have to, like, do something else because I have to take care of my siblings. But her siblings also encourage her, and there's this weird thing about her, because her like little sister says this thing which I think sort of sums up what the series might be about, and it's kind of creepy and weird, which is that the girl can change her face, emotion, sort of like everything about her, like in an instant. And her sister's like, that's really terrifying unless you're an actress. So you need to go be an actress. Otherwise, for you to just exist like this is horrifying. So, you know, you need to go do this thing. And so she's doing like one last audition sort of thing. And she does get called back because the director really senses something about her. But then it's this agency and the head of the agency, the president lady, is like, no, that girl, something's wrong with her. I feel as though she will be so absorbed that it's like it would be a bad thing. So she doesn't get it. But then the director is like, fine, well, I'm gonna like make my movie, you know, some other way, and goes to like try to recruit this girl. And so, yeah, there's just something like very off about her. And I don't know if it's where exactly it's going with it. And, you know, there's an audition of her where they pit like a bunch of the girls against each other to portray like this rabid dog coming out of the forest or something like that. And, you know, they each have to sort of pantomime the whole scene. And they're all like blown away by her ability to like get into the mouth, you know, everything. And I thought that the way that it's all drawn was very dramatic and cool and good. But it was just such a not what I was expecting at all from Shonen Jump.
It's totally stuck in my head, so I have to say it. I'm reminded of this one comedian's act who's like, Sinbad, man, he only had two choices in life, legendary sailor or comedian. And since legendary sailor isn't a job anymore, he really only had comedian. But no, it is interesting that the way you describe it, it seems so like 70s shoujo manga.
And the way that it's drawn, it isn't, but definitely plot-wise, it feels that way. And I don't totally know where it's going, which I like. I have not read the next chapter of it yet, so this is all my impressions from the first chapter.
No, it just, I wonder how much... I mean, Shonen Jump is kind of famous. I mean, I introduced this segment by talking about the meat grinder. But I feel, and maybe this is just perception more than anything else, like the grinder has turned up a little more recently as they like search for the next hit. And once again, One Piece is still doing fine. You know, My Hero is definitely not a slouch. But I feel like... I wonder how much they're going for, like, things that are a little more out of their normal comfort zone. Like, those series also tend to have a high turnover. Like, all right, we're going to run it. It didn't catch on. And so, I don't know. I feel like it's interesting to see them, you know, go outside their comfort zone. I mean, it has worked for them in the past. I feel like Death Note didn't feel like a lot of other stuff. And that, you know, is still a franchise that is viable today.
Yeah, and for this one, I don't know if it's going to go in sort of a disturbing...
Black Swan-y.
Semi-horror way, or if it's really about acting and how absorbed you get. I don't know, but it definitely caught my attention. I would definitely recommend people check it out, so...
Yeah, and the only thing is, like... Stuff like the title that jumps to my mind is Cross Manage, because it felt so Shonen Sunday-y and it got killed quickly. If this series is popular, I wonder how much is outside of Shonen Jump's normal wheelhouse. I'm always like a little concerned about series like that, because I feel like there are a good chance for different paths to open up in a magazine like that. They have to take hold against an audience that maybe is expecting more of the same. But hopefully it will innovate and draw some attention. Last month, we talked about Cardcaptor Sakura. And since my sister is a big Clamp fan, and Cardcaptor Sakura has kind of retaken fandom, at least to a little degree, because of the Clear Card anime, they recently replayed the second Cardcaptor Sakura movie, Cardcaptor Sakura and the Sealed Card. Me and Carol went to see that in the theater, which... It's really interesting looking, because they also played, right after that, they played the prologue OVA, which basically animates the manga ending, and the manga ending and the anime ending are very different from each other. So it was a little interesting to go back and one, just see how the movie played out and how they originally ended the anime, and then to think about how much of any of this are they going to incorporate into the new series. The movie has, there are a lot of little differences. Like you mentioned, in the manga, doesn't Errol give Sakura's dad like a little bit of his power?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, he gives him the ability to see the mom, the dead ghost mom, which Toya used to have, but Toya no longer has.
Mm-hmm. And there are other little differences. But, like, the real big change is in the movie, there's, like, this sealed card that's, like, hidden under Errol's mansion that Clow Reed created to, like, balance out all the other cards. It awakens and starts stealing all the cards from Sakura. And then it not only starts stealing the cloud cards, it starts stealing parts of the town. And eventually Sakura has to figure out what the card steal is and figure out how to basically talk to the card and find out what it wants and basically give back everything. So it was really interesting that the movie has this slowly building avalanche of momentum. It starts out really, everybody's doing stuff and extremely slice of lifey, and Mei Lin and Lee come back and from Hong Kong for a little while. And then eventually the cards start disappearing and little parts of the town start disappearing. They hardly even notice it. And then more of the town is disappearing. Things are getting more catastrophic. The momentum is really picking up. And then boom, boom, boom. By the end, the emergency brake is gone and it's going like down the hill full speed. And then the movie ends. Which I just thought was very different pacing than a lot of, like, the rest of Sakura has a very traditional rising and falling action, whereas I feel like the movie had, yeah, that weird avalanche of just slowly building till the end, and it pretty much climaxes, and there's not even much of an epilogue, it's just, like, maybe 2 minutes of, like, falling action, which I thought was interesting. I feel like while they might keep some of the stuff from the TV series, Lee and Mei Lin coming back in like the middle of when he was gone in the manga, and then just like this sealed card, which becomes like the hope card and all this other stuff, I feel like it's just all stuff that is probably never going to be mentioned. I mean, I think we were all surprised in the last episode that not only like have they mentioned Mei Lin, but she actually appeared on screen for a little while. And she's still in Hong Kong and was just like over like a Skype call. But like they theoretically could bring her back for an episode or two and like, or even more than that. At least that much they've acknowledged. So it'll be interesting to see what parts of the original TV series, like, do they mention any of, like, the anime original cards? But then again, we haven't seen any of the original cards in the new series, so. And I will say, it was, like, the theater, since, you know, it is a movie you can see on, you know, like, Blu-ray and DVD here. I'd say the theater was only about half filled. But man, there was, like, one girl, like, 4 or 5 rows down. Anytime anything even slightly romantic happened, she very much had a reaction that I could hear.
Whoa, turn it down a little bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was like, I don't need your commentary track, ma'am. But it was enjoyable. It was a fun movie. Yeah, it definitely is like the end to the anime canon.
I don't remember the movies being that well regarded in the...
The problem with the first movie is that it just totally feels like side story, anime filler, Gaiden in the extreme. I mean, it's, you know, random woman who used to love Clow Reed makes problems, and then they tell her, and then they convince her.
Stop that.
Yeah, they tell her, stop that. Clowry's dead. You're dead. Get over it. And she's like, why? I guess I should.
Thank you for your helpful counseling.
Maybe that he's not that into you because he's dead. I feel like the second one, like I just said, felt like more of a ending, especially since they didn't have the manga ending. But I thought it was enjoyable. I don't think it was like my favoritest Cardcaptor story or anything, but you know, for an anime original ending, I felt like it had a pretty good punch. Although once again, I would say that it did start rather slowly, but what are you gonna do? Since Amazon Strike is dead, I've tried to catch up on some of the series that were extremely well regarded that we like missed out on. Because of that, I decided to start pretty simple with Land of the Lustrous, because it was probably the series I heard the most positive things about, but it was also the series that was the shortest.
Good call. I really want to watch the rest of this one too. Yeah.
Because it was only 12 episodes, whereas the other ones are like 22 plus. So I was like, well, if you get the most praise and I can finish you the quickest, there's really no reason for me not to try you out. As I mentioned, if you read the My Manga of the Month, friend of the blog, Carl from Ugawe Maniacs, he often reads Afternoon because his favorite manga is Genshin, and Genshin runs in Afternoon. And so occasionally he'll buy the books, and he's like, every time I like look at Land of the Lustrous, like I can't figure it out. And he has a PhD in manga, so it's not like he's some manga noob who's like, how do I manga? And after watching the series, I'm like, oh, I totally get it. This is an anime that you have to see from the beginning because it has an extremely alien world that doesn't work like ours. And you need like the introduction to see how the world works and how these characters function. If you were thrown in the middle, you would just have no idea. Which I think is both a little bit of a detriment and a selling point in the series. It is definitely not like anything else you've watched, but it is also very much its own thing and very determined in that sense. So yeah, it's about this world where there are these gem people and they are effectively immortal. Technically, they theorize they can be killed, but if they're shattered, they can be reassembled. So essentially, something has to happen to either shatter them and then disperse them into so many little pieces that it is infeasible to bring them back together, or something like melts or just utterly disintegrates them. But they have this threat of these Lunarians, these people from the moon who can come down and whisk them away to the moon, and anybody who's been whisked to the way to the moon has never been seen again, so they just assume that they've been killed. And the main character is Foz, whose full name is like her gem type, which is super hard
the scientific name
for it. So we will just call her Foz because that is easy to say. And the mangaka also realizes that name is a mouthful, so Foz. And she is a gem with
they.
Because it's weird.
I detriment to you. I just thought
because I've seen
take it that way.
I've seen he, she, and they. and like that, apparently there are whole long debates over which of those you should use. Some of the gems used very gendered pronouns. Some of them use genderless pronouns. Some of them use mixes. So, and like I've seen, like generally, like the generous translators are like, it's complicated. The mangaka has gotten the record saying that all of the gems are genderless. So I think, if I remember, the official translation just tries to use as gender neutral as possible. And just makes notes in the translation notes when characters like the doctor uses completely gender neutral, like very formal pronouns and for everybody, whereas like Diamond, who's very girly, uses super girly pronouns. Foes, they are one of the softest gems, so they shatter easily, so they're not really great for combat, and they're not particularly the smartest or have some skill.
Or the most dedicated.
The monk who pretty much takes care of all the gems, and it's not clear if they are a gem, a human, or something else. Heck, they might be a Lunarian, since we never actually possibly see, like, the Lunarians send these things that are like this mixture of like Hindu and Buddhist statuaries that try to whisk them back to the moon, but it's a little unclear if those are actually the Lunarians or if they're just the machines that the Lunarians send to get gems.
So, are you saying that from the first episode, or are you saying that even after watching 12 episodes, you don't know the answer to that? Without necessarily giving spoilers, just do you get answers to these kinds of questions? Or are you left with a lot more questions?
It's a little hard to tell because I think you maybe meet a Lunarian pet but they leave that vague. Even at the end of the anime, you're not sure if you've ever met a Lunarian. You learn a little more about them, and you learn about another race that lives on the planet that's kind of their own faction. But yeah, the Lunarians are still a big mystery at the end of the anime. In fact, I'd say in general, the anime is the end of the prologue.
Wow.
Because it's like, Fo is very different, is a very different character by the end of the series, but you feel they are now on a different journey than when they started, but they're still on their original journey, because basically the monk that is in charge of the gems tells Fo to start an encyclopedia, because if nothing else, they can at least do that. And in goofadoofing around, they learn that there's another gem named Cinnabar, who, because they produce poison, as actual Cinnabar does, they live and like patrol at night because the gems are photosynthetic, but because of Cinnabar's weird poison, they can operate at night. They can basically absorb light in the morning and keep it in the poison at night, and so they can operate at night. And they patrol at night, but apparently the Lunarians never attack at night. So it's kind of like a time waster job, much like Foes has. So Foes, in the beginning, is determined to find Cinnabar. I mean, this is the end of the first episode. Find Cinnabar a new job. And that is still Foes' job by the end. But there's also, as Foes learns more about how the world works and becomes more capable and basically aware and motivated, I don't want to go into it, but they're actually starting to look for the answers to a lot of these mysteries of the universe. What are the Lunarians? What do they want? You know, who is the monk? Why are they doing it? You know, where did the gems come from? Who are these this other race that you eventually meet? And how do they play into all this? And so, I feel like it feels like, all right, this was the prologue to get Foes thinking about all of these things and introducing both the audience and Foes to these things so that they can start actual chapter one of real investigation of these ideas and these mysteries.
So how satisfying did you find that? Obviously, the manga is available in English, mm-hmm. thankfully, and so you can pick up possibly where it left off, but do you feel as though, how satisfied, I guess, were you with just the anime?
I mean, it really felt like one of those old OVAs where, like, they tease you with, I mean, it has an endpoint where you get a pretty big bum-bum-bum, but it does not feel like, and then I could end there. Like I said, I'm not sure if I've actually met a real Lunarian yet.
Yeah, I feel as though you don't have any of the answers.
You basically, at the end, have, all right, these I think are the priority questions I want answered.
Here's my outline.
Yes. One interesting thing that I think is an interesting part of the series is the gems are basically all of themselves, and so they can get chipped away, and usually they're reassembled and they're fine. But if they ever permanently lose any part of themselves, they lose like a percentage of their memory, because basically their memories are stored in throughout all of them. So if you like lose a hand, you just happen to lose whatever memories you had that were stored in your hands. And so Foes loses several body parts as the series goes on, and they're replaced, and so they get more powerful and they get more abilities, but they're also losing parts of themselves and their memories. Like at one point, not to be too spoilery, but Foes loses a body part and they can't talk to anybody for a while, and when they get back, they're like, oh good, you're back. Oh wow, you lost another body part, wacky. And they're like, oh, go tell Cinnabar this. And they're like, who's Cinnabar? And then, like, when they describe Cinnabar to Foes, she's like, oh, all right, I kind of remember them, cool. And they're like, oh man. And it's like an interesting dynamic of, like, I've seen a lot of people bring this up. Do you know the Ship of Theseus paradox? All right, so Theseus's ship is the ship they use on the Odyssey. And the Odyssey, you know, the Trojan War ends. They try to get back home. They go on this, like, decade-long trip home. One of the interesting things is every part of the ship of Theseus is destroyed at some point on the journey. And they have to replace it. But never all at once. They never, like, lose the whole ship and get on another ship. You know, maybe harpies attack and they lose the masts. And then a kraken attacks and they lose part of the hull. But by the end of this journey, the paradox is, if no parts of the ship are the ship they left on, is it still really Theseus's ship? And if it isn't, at what point would you no longer call that ship Theseus's ship? Is it when over half of it is new material? Is it when that last piece is gone? Is it 75%? And that's kind of the journey Foes is on. Every time they lose a piece of themselves, like, they actually have a decent amount of character growth, and they become more capable. They're actually, because there's a lot of Buddhist imagery, they're actually, like, ascending the levels of Buddhist treasures and, like, overcoming a character flaw. But they're also losing parts of what made them the original Foes. Like, if all of Foes is gone and replaced by better parts, is that good? Is that just Foes becoming better? Is that Foes disappearing and this other person who's technically better replacing her? Is that a tragedy or a, like, point of celebration? Is it neither? Is it both? And I feel like, not going into it, those are just one of the many kind of philosophical points that the show brings up and I think handles very interestingly.
Well, maybe I'll just read the manga then, because...
I mean, I do feel, like I mentioned in the manga of the month, they do feel a little different. You might actually like the manga, because I feel like it feels very 70s shoujo, whereas I feel... the anime feels a little more modern, thoughtful action. Just because of the animation, I feel like they pay a little more attention to the action in the anime. And the manga has a very, like, 70s shoujo style, even though it's in a modern seinen magazine. But it just reminded me of those, like, very ambitious 70s manga, especially with how it plays with identity and broad philosophical topics. So I almost feel like there's a value in sampling both, at least for a little while, to see which one, you know, you have more of a vibe with. But I personally think you would enjoy the manga more just because of the 70s shoujo style. But I feel like there's value in both of them. The only other value is the anime basically ends with the prologue, whereas the manga is ongoing and, you know, officially licensed in the US, so you can continue on the story there. Whereas I have not heard anything about there being new anime, but from what I've seen, the anime Blu-rays and DVDs have been selling really well. Like, they're usually the top sellers the week they come out, which is usually a pretty good indicator. They're probably at least contemplating making more anime. Unless, like, you know, there was some huge fight between, like, the manga creator and the anime studio or something like that. Or, like, some crazy production committee nonsense in the background. I would think there would be more, but I would not guarantee that in any way. But yeah, there's value to both of them. I thought the anime was cool. It's maybe a good way to, if you have Amazon Prime, to sample it and then, like, decide if you want to go out and buy the manga. Or you could just do like I did and go to the library and test it out there. But I feel like you get enough different that you wouldn't be remiss in watching and then reading at the same time.
All right, I've made a lot of progress in my One Piece catch-up project, challenge, whatever.
Yeah, man, when you said that you got through a Punk Hazard, I was like, what?
Yeah, so last time we talked about One Piece, I had gotten up to the time skip. You know, Paramount War had occurred, and now I've finished the first two arcs after the time skip, after everybody's gotten back together, and I've seen Fishman Island, and that's not even officially into the New World yet. The first one into the New World is Punk Hazard, and I finished that arc also. And I'm actually already starting Dressrosa, but I don't don't want to talk about it since it just started it, and we can just, you know, table that until later. But both of these arcs, I kind of went in blind, and I think I talked about this the last time, that pretty much this point onward, nobody has spoiled anything for me. I don't really know anything except some random stuff about the current arc, and that's mostly because everybody just likes to torture me about how it's about that guy who should die. So there was so many surprises in these arcs that I was just making exclamations the whole time I was reading. So Fishman Island, I really liked. I thought it started off a little bit slowly and kind of not super grabbing my attention, but then once it gets into its backstory arc, or showing us the past for Fisher Tiger and the Sun Pirates, and we learn a whole bunch about Shirahoshi's mom and the queen, you know, the queen of the island and everything that was going on with them, I just really loved that backstory. I thought it was very emotionally moving and just so relevant. I think the Fishman Island arc blew me away in that it's got like race relations and extremism and like xenophobia and government conspiracy, which is the core basis of all of One Piece. But here I just thought it did it in such a way that it made it maybe the most real world equivalent arc that I've seen in One Piece, where it felt as if Oda was making a really specific connection, a race connection.
You're not saying that Punk Hazard is soft.
Punk Hazard does have people hooking kids on drugs, so also relevant.
You know, it was interesting because I feel like Kit kind of mentioned, I feel like I don't hear as many people having big opinions about any arc past the time skip, other than most people really thinking that Fishman Island was weak. So the fact that Kate took so well to it, I was like, huh, interesting. And like past this point, I only have my opinions on any of the arcs. Like I don't have like, most fans think X or most fans think Y. I was very curious to see Kate's, like, super positive reaction to Fishman Island.
I will say that it's not as if...
it's a perfect arc.
Not perfect. It has one of the weaknesses that I think we've talked about a lot in the later arcs, whereas I don't think that the villain in that story is strong. I don't think he's a super memorable villain, but I thought that sort of the core themes of the arc were some of the strongest, and I really liked seeing Genbei. I liked the whole royal family. I really liked Shirahoshi. I was super blown away by what her power is, what it means, how it will be relevant. I'm just super excited to know and to see. I don't want to like super spoil One Piece for anybody, because I feel like One Piece is so hard at this point because obviously it's like insanely long. So if I say something about One Piece right now and you've never read One Piece, is it going to matter to you? Probably not. But then like, it's hard to know how to balance the, the spoilers for it. So I don't want to say too much.
But I do feel like I think the part that might sell people who like maybe tuned out during or after the time skip, or have like, oh, I heard Fishman Island was super weak, so I didn't read it anymore. I feel like the parts that really sold you on that are parts that I feel like we could talk about and are worth talking about. And, you know, some minor spoilers, but Shirahoshi's deal, I feel like you said, is not really, it's interesting. It's really cool if this was like, you know, if we were the One Piece podcast and we were, you know, having a spoilers section, we'd totally bring that up. But for... as a case for or against, like, should someone read this or go back to the series, I don't really feel that's relevant. I feel like it's the racial stuff, the xenophobia stuff, the roles of government and people. Those are the parts that are slight spoilers, but worth spoiling to talk about, whereas that's, like, cool lore.
And I will say that I do feel the arc takes a little while to get ramped up. Or not even just the arc, but kind of post-time skip, I think, actually takes a little while to get interesting again. Obviously, we have the characters sort of first trying to get back together, which takes a little while to happen. And then once they do and they go to Fishman Island, they're almost immediately separated. And I don't think that that was great because we had sort of like, you know, because before the time skip, they're also all separated. We haven't seen them together since before Paramount War. So I think it was kind of a poor choice to separate them so quickly. And of course, in all these arcs, like, they tend to get separated because certain characters are too powerful to hang out with these characters, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I do feel like it almost seemed like it was just not quite finding the right footing after how do I get them back together? And then what do I do next? So I do think it takes a little while to warm up, but then I thought Fishman Island got really good. And then I was like really into it. It's also a lot easier, I'm sure, for me reading the books and not reading it week to week because it's not actually that long of an arc. So I think you can kind of get through it pretty quickly if you've been turned off by the beginning of it.
Because I did feel like people felt like it felt like Jaya, which was, you know, the arc kind of just after Baroque Works, which was supposed to show off like how Luffy had grown from Baroque Works. And this was basically supposed to show how everybody in the crew has grown after the time skip. And I think the general feeling was it just went on too long for that. Which I always felt like was a little, but Jai only had to worry about Luffy, whereas Fishman Island has to have time to tell this whole story and also show off what all the new, basically what all the Straw Hats have learned from their journeys and, you know, training and all that.
And I also feel it does a really good job of reintroducing what we started to learn on Sabaody, because I think it the sort of the realities of the new world and the world government were started to be revealed there, but then we go to Paramount War and obviously that has to do with the world government, but it's sort of like a big battle and crazy things are happening and it's so much more battle-y. And then I think this takes us back to the sort of the harshness of the world to be talking about how humans pretend to be friends with the fishmen, but really it's just to like get advantage and things like that. And then how the fishmen are like, we're like way better than you. Why should, or certain, you know, certain factions being like, why should we be subservient to you? We can freaking breathe underwater and like are part fish, you know, and all this stuff. So I think it is also kind of this reintroduction to like, hey, remember how the nobles suck so bad? Remember, here's a bunch of things. And also how there's this faction of the fishermen that want to like emigrate and be part of, you know, live alongside and, you know, how you sabotage that or sacrifice that or how you maybe have the best of intentions, but you can't actually follow through with that and like all of these racial tensions. So I think it brings you kind of back to the seriousness of what kind of world people are living in when they're not just pirates fighting crazy battles. Also, Luffy stuffs a giant mermaid into a giant shark to sort of accidentally kidnap her. So definitely be in for that.
The part I was like, I just remember that like creeper dude who was like totally creeping on Shirahoshi. And I just remember,
yeah,
I remember his plot line should have just been wrapped up a little quicker.
Another so on the nose real world example, because this guy is obsessed with her and stalking her and is basically like, I love her, I want to marry her, da-da-da-da-da-da. Oh, she doesn't like me, well then I'll just murder her. That's for real what he says. So like, thank you for bringing that reality out. It's like, great, luckily she's all right, don't worry. So then we go from that to Punk Hazard, which Fishman Island, amazing like in its themes and stuff, but then Punk Hazard reveals so much about what's been going on in the last 2 years.
Parts that apparently I didn't remember.
I don't blame you, because there is so much that is revealed in here that it would be hard to, you need like a cataloged, you know, listing for all the stuff. And despite my mention earlier that this is an arc about hooking children on drugs, it's a lighthearted arc about hooking children on drugs. Like, I mean...
The lighthearted chapter about hooking children on drugs for families.
And human experimentation. Yeah, the thing is that the arc plays itself like it's really silly, and there are parts of it that are super silly. But also those things happen, and there are actually... I thought there was actually some very moving sections, very small, short sections in here, where a lot of characters who have been duped by Caesar Clown on Punk Hazard have been duped into, like, either trusting him or working for him. And they have these moments where they kind of break down and realize that has happened. And this is someone that they really trusted and thought that they had saved them. And I thought it was really devastating the way that it was portrayed. I was very impressed because even though, obviously, as a reader, there's no way you're going to be like, Caesar Clown, I mean, he was like such a good dude. There's never a moment where you're ever gonna think that. But the way that these characters felt about him, I think Oda just did such an amazing job of conveying what they felt and then their betrayal and their kind of reaction and emotional devastation from that happening. I was like, oh, I'm like a little bit
verklempt.
Yeah, like, whoa, man, wow. Poor Brownbeard. And you'll like never remember who Brownbeard is again, but you probably don't even remember who that is. But it had like a moment. But then, of course, there's like body switching, and that all happens though so that we can find out what the frick Trafalgar Law's power is. That's essentially why that's in here. And I think, no, I was gonna say him showing up was the first like whoa moment, but it wasn't, because the first whoa moment is that we know that Aokiji, who's like the ice, he's an ice guy, and Akainu, who is a bastard who also uses fire, they have a big old battle with each other on this island, and their massive battle has changed the landscape of this island, so half of it is fire and half of it is ice. And they used to be allies, you know, before the time skip they were allies, so we know that, you know, big things have been happening. And so then we have this crazy island and this crazy man who I did a good job here of calling him Caesar Clown and not Caesar the Clown, like, because of course I'm always thinking Buggy, how can you have another clown? And then, you know, but he's a former assistant to Dr. Vegapunk, who is another character that we've just only heard the name of, and we know that they are important, but now we're seeing, you know, maybe this is like their former island where they had a lab, and like, how does Caesar fit in with whatever Vegapunk has been researching? You know, there's that, and then the end, like, you know, we've got Luffy and Trafalgar Law, and the Navy has shown up, and so Smoker is on this island, and there's like a triple alliance, which is like the greatest alliance I've ever seen. And
I did have the revelation that, like, oh, and other people might have mentioned this before, but oh, Smoker is their Zenigata, and the Straw Hat crew is the Lupin gang.
I love it. I love it because I love Smoker, and I always want him to show up. Obviously, he can't show up too much, but I just love him. And I love that he you know, he's the one of the few actually good people in the Navy that's trying to do, you know, who can see the gray of the world of pirates and, you know, the Navy. So this arc is super important because Trafalgar Law is this character we kind of barely meet. You know, he helps out Luffy before the time skip, and then it's like, okay, whatever. And then he shows up here, and you're like, what is it? Like, who? All right, like, why is this guy here? And he really grew on me throughout the arc. Like, at first I was like, man, this guy, he seems like too overpowered and whatnot. I just, whatever, man. But then once I started like learning how his power worked, and also that he tries to approach Luffy as if Luffy is logical and smart.
I quickly learned that was a very bad miscalculation.
It's just so good. good. I mean, Trafalgar is really the straight man to the Straw Hat crew, at least in this arc. And just to see him foiled over and over again when he's like, Luffy, here's the plan. And Luffy just does whatever he wants.
You know what it is? I feel like he's like trying to play this complicated three-dimensional chess match with Luffy. And Luffy is like, all right, I'm going to play these like checkers because I know how to play checkers and checkers is fun. And like somehow Law can't stop him.
You can't. You can't stop Luffy. You know, I mean, even the way that this arc begins is, you know, this is their first time in the new world. There's a totally different way of navigating the sea. It doesn't work. The log pose doesn't work in the same way. There's weird, I really don't understand it at all, how you get to island. And Luffy's like, I want to go there. And Nami's like, all right, fine, great. Because like, if you want to do something, obviously we have to do it. It just doesn't even matter what I say now. If that, like, I like that she is pretty much at this stage knows that there's just no point in...
Like, she has to choose her battles. Yeah. And she's like, is this a battle that, in the end, favors Nami enough for Nami to fight this battle? No. Then I don't give a fuck.
Yeah. And will I win this? Nope. You know we're gonna end up there. So they just do. And I like that Trafalgar Law is just constantly fighting against that. And he'll never win against Luffy. And I don't want to say too much about all the many things that you learn in the last book of this arc. There's about 45 things that are revealed to you, and they all, one after the another, blew my mind. I was fearing for Smoker's life twice in one volume, like legit worried that he was gonna die. I'm super excited to see, you know, how all these many different alliances and just people's plots, whatever they might be, kind of bubble up.
Especially considering what basically leads into the next arc.
I have so many thoughts. I mean, I loved it. And I have to say that when they revealed who the seven warlords are now currently are, and they don't reveal one of them. One of them is still a mystery, but six of the seven. My heart was lifted. I was filled with delight. I was wondering about a character, you know, what has been going on with so-and-so? I always want to know. And then there they were. So I really enjoyed that. I will say, though, that the arc itself, you know, again, I didn't think it had a super strong villain. There was a bunch of reveals, but they weren't kind of really about this arc. They were about greater things. And those are all the things that were so interesting about it, as opposed to like this arc. Well, except for the stuff about Devil Fruit in here. I mean, that's like a big, obviously that's a huge piece of the puzzle here, so.
In a way, as much as people called Fishman Island Jaya, I feel like this is the Jaya for Dessarosa. Like, this sets up Dessarosa. And I mean, Caesar Clown is important in that one. And he's actually even important in the next arc. So I feel like in many ways, the Straw Hat crew, the whole point of this arc, get the Straw Hat crew to get Caesar Clown to set up the next two arcs.
Because, like, yeah, I mean, obviously I don't know that because I have only just started the next arc, but...
But, I mean, you already see how he's already...
He's important.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, I didn't feel as though, you know, Punk Hazard doesn't have a strong theme, a through theme. It doesn't really have a lot of... It doesn't really have a bunch of, like, backstories that are super interesting. All the characters within this arc, despite what I said about those few emotional beats that I thought were really good, are not significant or all that interesting. The other thing that I was really surprised about going into this next arc is that they meet this samurai on this island when they first get there, and he's still with them in Dessarosa, and I was really surprised because very few characters, unless they become obviously a crew member, I feel as though that they follow them from another arc to the next arc. So I thought that was very interesting.
No, I mean, not to be too many spoilers, but essentially, Oda recently said, once we finish this Year of Sanji plot, we can finally get around to that samurai plot.
Wow! Jeez, they still haven't tackled that? That's amazing.
I mean, that character does a lot more, and you get to find out stuff. But, like, the seeds planted there still haven't fully, like, this, the whole part of Punk Hazard seemed to be like setting up the next like four arcs.
I find that very odd.
Yeah, no.
And I also don't find the samurai very interesting at all. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, really? Like, who is this guy gonna turn out to really be somebody? Because I don't think it's that interesting.
He's mostly a background dude for a while. Like, I feel like when they get to his home country, and you'll meet one or two other people who are associated with him in the arc, the like little mini arc.
I just feel as though this is a lot of time spent with a character who is not a crew member, who is not gonna be probably a crew member.
No. He's definitely just a plot element.
It just seems like a lot of time spent on a character that doesn't seem that important, but maybe they will reveal something to me and I'll understand it better, but it seems really like an odd choice to me at the moment. But then again, I'm also often wondering why Sanji is not dead. So, you know, maybe my opinion is not the be-all end-all of what should be going on in One Piece.
I do find it weird that, and once again, not to be too spoilery, there's this girl named Carrot who, like, when they split up the team and only some of the people go on the Sanji arc, she, like, is a member. And she, much like the samurai, feels like, oh, she's going to be there for this arc. And then when that arc is over, she'll go back and do what she does. And she'll probably come back at some later point. But it seemed like she's just there to kind of be like, you know, when you're playing at like an RPG and you just get like that temporary party member like that. And I feel like the samurai guy feels like that as well. Like this random temp member that like is very clearly not supposed to be a full, like, you're not even supposed to like, I wonder if they're going to join the crew. Like, you know, you're like, no, you're not going to join the crew. But they also stay around longer than like a totally minor character. Yeah, like, they're like,
and I don't understand why.
More than a wiper, less than a brook.
I do wonder if he's around just for some Zoro stuff, possibly. Because I know he can do at least one move that Zoro definitely can't do. And Zoro has one of, like, the sword that is from his home country. And Zoro's like, it's mine. And the samurai's like, I think you should return that, you thief. And he's like, I didn't steal it from you guys. Somebody else stole it from you and I got it.
Fine, just keep first. Yeah. Loses weepers.
Yeah, so, you know, again, maybe I will understand as the things go on. I just was very surprised that he was still around. And the last thing I want to say about the Punk Hazard arc and the time skip is that I really love that people keep referring to Luffy and Trafalgar Law and all those characters as the worst generation, because I just keep hearing millennials every time somebody says it.
These millennial pirates, always on their smart denden mushies.
Yes.
They don't want to work for their treasure like pirates of old.
They eat devil fruit toast or whatever. Yeah, I just really love it. Because that's all I can see when it happens. So I'm really enjoying it. I'm so glad that I'm catching up. I'm very excited to be completely caught up because, as I've been talking about this with other people, you know, I'm throwing out theories or questions, and finally people are saying, we don't know the answer to that yet. Like, and I'm like, whoa!
I am like, who is that warlord they don't talk about? I'm like, I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine.
I'm like, woo, you know? So I'm excited that almost to be on equal footing soon.
Yeah, yeah. I'll be very curious what you think of Dressrosa and the little mini art in between that and the worst timeline.
I can say that I already really like Dressrosa because it's an island of misfit toys. I was super excited when I saw that.
Yeah, so yeah, it'll be interesting to see what you think of, like, the characters they introduce, the ideas they introduce. Yeah, it'll be fun.
Yeah, so I think the next time I talk about One Piece on here will be after I'm completely caught up. So, not that I'm really gonna read
the darkest top.
Yeah, no, I'll just skim, but that counts.
this episode's food for thought. Since we were talking a lot about arcs in One Piece, I was curious what each of our favorite arc of One Piece is and what the audience's favorite arc of One Piece, if they've read it, is. Listen to our song! Answer to the food for thought.
Since we talked a lot about One Piece, we're wondering what you guys' favorite One Piece arc is. And of course, we'll talk about our own. So, Al, since I just talked a whole ton about One Piece, why don't you go first?
Okay, Kate, I have one rule. We can't both pick Skypiea. Like, one of us has to not pick Skypiea. I mean, even though we both super love Skypiea as the bestest arc that ever did arc.
I mean, it is one of the funniest, I thought. It had some of the funniest moments, but
I think it is universally considered the weakest arc.
I would agree with that. It's even weaker than that one where they have the boat race or whatever. The
Davy back fights? I think, like, the Davy back fights is so short. The thing after Dessarosa is such a, like, mini arc that most people don't almost factor it into.
I can tell you that the One Piece wiki freaking thinks everything is an arc, okay? Mm. Every fucking island they ever thought of is, like, its own arc on that goddamn unhelpful website.
So, I guess I'll pick the cheapest answer.
Well, we've talked a ton about One Piece, so we won't talk about too much. How's that?
All right. I was going to say probably Baroque Works. I almost feel like it's like the default answer. Anyone that isn't Baroque Works is the more interesting choice. But once again, it just has a really strong villain, a great building of tension. Vivi is great and really should come back as the last crew member.
I like how that's just, like, in service to everything we've ever, like, we just have to slide that into every One Piece conversation just to, you know, put it out there in the world.
You know, it has some great fight. I think everybody at one point plays, a great role. You don't feel like anybody was, like, not doing anything in that arc. The surprise of Nico Robin at the end is just so shocking.
I don't think any other crew member has been really a surprise like that. Just really out of absolutely nowhere. And she's one of the few crew members that it actually works when Luffy, because Luffy pretty much offers anyone cool he meets to have them join the crew. That's his thing. He just says it to all kinds of people. And in this case, it actually works.
I feel like it's like the universally beloved arc. Like, if you don't love that arc, if you're like, man, I thought it was actually weak, or it isn't your favorite, it's usually, like, the odd point.
I can understand if it's a not your favorite, but if you thought it was weak, you're wrong. And now that I'm really two arcs away from being caught up, I do think it's insanely strong. I mean, I feel as though it holds up, and I understand why maybe it's still people's favorites even this far along. So I think that totally makes sense. That's the right answer. My favorite arc is probably Paramount War. And I actually feel really bad picking Paramount War because the rest of the crew is not involved in that story. But by the time Paramount War happens, Luffy is by far and away my favorite character. And that story is just incredible and devastating and, you know, just so both emotionally impactful and just battle crazy amazing impactful and practically blows up the world kind of, you know, monumental battle.
I think the amazing part from like a purely technical standpoint, like you've mentioned a lot of the story beats, is how he creates so many pirate captains under Whitebeard and Navy admirals and like captains for that battle who are probably never going to appear again or only minorly ever appear again.
Or died.
Yeah. Yeah. Who just like, yeah, either only exist in that arc because they're just not going to be mentioned again, or they're dead and they're by unless they come back as zombies. Are just there to shine in that singular moment, which I was like, that's kind of like crazy. And it was like, oh, it's not like some editorial decision, like someone, you know, the head of Shonen Jump was like, don't bring those characters, weren't popular, never bring them back. It was like, nope, I just wanted to have this war, so I made all these characters. And I'm sure, once again, some of those pirates and some of those admirals will come back in later stories. But I'm guessing about like 80% of them won't. If they weren't already important characters in. Obviously, Crocodile's going to come back again. Obviously, Buggy's going to come back again.
I can't wait for those moments. I also think that I'm before Paramount War, definitely, but I feel as though at this point I wonder how much editorial control there is at all. Oda is so successful that, you know, that the like, you don't get to tell me what to do, like, this is how it's gonna be. And I'm fine with that because I think overall he's doing a great job. So I just like when you said having an editor say, oh, get rid of this person, I'm just trying to imagine Oda being like, have you seen my serial killer line and board with all the strings on it? I can't.
Or he just points towards like the sales numbers of his last manga. I think they're gonna side with me, not you, Mr. Editor. So, you know, how much do you want to push this? You better have a pretty good case for it, because otherwise, I think I'm going to win. The most fascinating news and conversations from this month.
All right, so since we're talking about One Piece, and that's a Viz title, I think it's a good segue into talking about this recent list that came out from BookScan, which is the best-selling manga in the U.S. for 2017, or the top 20 best-selling. And all of them are Viz. Every single thing on the list.
So I guess, like, the Monster Girl craze has died down, that Seven Seas isn't in the top-selling manga?
I mean, I don't know. I don't remember this list from a previous year, so I don't really have it anything to compare it to. It's just a little bit shocking. The other shocking part about that is despite us talking about One Piece and despite One Piece's popularity the world over, One Piece doesn't appear on this list.
Yeah, no, I noticed a lot of like Tokyo Ghoul.
And yeah, this list, just in case you haven't seen it, is every volume can be on here, so it's not as if they've compressed, all right, this entire series was the best-selling, so this is by volume, so it's just individual what sold the most this year, so a lot of, like, new stuff, and just lots of multiple volumes of popular series. So like Al said, Tokyo Ghoul, in fact, Tokyo Ghoul is the number one, and volume one, followed by My Hero Academia Volume 1 and Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess Volume 1. And then some more Zelda and then One Punch Man And then it basically, pretty much goes between all of those things for the rest of them. And there's, like, maybe one Naruto thing on there, and, like, a dragon, like, a Death Note thing, and then that's, you know, so it's those few series, just different volumes of all of them, basically.
I mean, we've said this a dozen times on this podcast. I almost feel like a broken record. But it's just amazing how well Viz does with its super popular series and how poorly it does with all its other series. It just, it seems like Viz is really good at selling the series that are, like, destined to sell and has no idea how to sell the rest of its catalog.
We've also talked about before how we just don't get the Tokyo Ghoul thing. It just does not hit us. We're not interested in it, but also, for the most part, the people that we sort of discuss anime and manga and, like, hang out with, like, are also not into it. I mean, I know a couple of people who like it, but it's very interesting how mega, 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 mega popular it is, but it's clearly a different generation, for the most part, of fan. Or different parallel fans that aren't us. I don't know. I get the feeling that it's younger.
Yeah, no. I mean, I've never, other than, like, one or two rare exceptions, yeah, I haven't seen that many, like, older Tokyo Ghoul fans.
And it says kind of later in this article that Tokyo Ghoul also appears as in the general graphic novel of all graphic novel best-selling top 20 for 2017. It's on that list as number 7. And most of the stuff on this list also rank somewhere in that 20. So, but they call out Tokyo Ghoul specifically, so I'm going to guess that it was the one that was the highest on that general list too. So that's very interesting. But mostly I want to bring this up because it just makes me sad that One Piece isn't on there. And is it just because at this point One Piece is just so long that, you know, volume 84 does not make it on here?
But I feel like Bleach, when it was popular, and Naruto were always on those lists. And it's not like those were, you know, 3 books and you're done series.
Yeah, I find it very interesting. Nothing on this list is, you know, it's mostly like the highest stuff is 10 and 11 volume, which is pretty significant to be selling that well for that high of a volume. I just find it interesting because I don't feel I looked at these lists a lot. I don't know if One Piece ever appeared on here or, and then it just slowly dropped off. As we know from many episodes of the show, it has not dropped off in Japan in any sense of the word. So I just think it's interesting that, why don't people love pirates more?
I don't know.
Why? Why don't they love Luffy more?
They all went Team Ninja Kid.
I guess they want something a little bit edgy. They need that.
What you're saying is all young fandom is full of edge lords. I gotcha.
I mean,
all right, you win. So, Kate, talking about the edginess and sadness, Crunchyroll Manga has some bad news for you to spark your inner young edge lord.
This is going to be the thing I need to start reading Tokyo Ghoul. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, correct.
Tell me.
So apparently they are gutting their back catalog in Crunchyroll Manga, Kodansha is. So any title that's being simulpubbed, they're going to continue doing that. But if you want a lot of the older volumes, basically, like anything that hasn't been collected into a volume, you're going to have to buy that online. Because now, you know, they're really trying to push their Kindle store selection. So, and just, you know, ebook selection. So, unlike, say, Crunchyroll Anime, where you can go back and, you know, watch, unless the title's been, like, totally removed, you can't go back and read the older titles for free like you could with the premium subscription in the past. And some of them are staying on if you have a premium subscription. I know they really, they're keeping on Fairy Tail. And like I said, anything that's being simulpubbed is still there.
But only the most recent, maybe, few chapters, right?
So, you know, if you wanted to, when does that happen?
It actually happens at the end of February, so they did not give a lot of lead time for this happening, so it doesn't give people a heck of a lot of chance to, oh man, I keep meaning to read whatever.
So, like, if you want to read Space Brothers, you better work at it, my friend. Or buy the books.
Yeah, I guess it's interesting. I think the Crunchyroll manga section doesn't feel as though it really took off for them.
Like, there was a time when they were, like, releasing, like, a new title a month, and then that just died for a while. And they've added one or two new titles recently, but, yeah, it seemed like they didn't kill it, but they didn't add anything new for the longest. And then this announcement came out just when they were kind of, like, peeking their head out and adding some new titles, which probably, I'm guessing personally that this shift of them taking off the titles was in the works, and then they just decided to put out those few titles to get people to look at it again and then drop this bombshell. But I could be wrong about that. That's idle speculation.
Yeah, I wonder if it will stick around for much longer. It just doesn't feel as though they're putting a lot of push behind it or effort behind it. You know, for the most part, all the problems of their reading app and sort of the format of things has been there since the beginning and has never once changed. I've posted numerous times about weird, annoying glitches. And again, they're just glitches. It's not as if it makes it impossible to read stuff on there, but they just don't feel to me that they're putting in a lot of time and effort into it.
And there are a lot of times where, like, pages will be misnumbered, or I noticed that a lot. Like, you'll get the classic, someone forgets to make the page 01 instead of 1, so it comes in the teens. Errors. It won't happen in every volume, but, you know, maybe every third volume you'll see a chapter that happens on. It's especially jarring if it's, like, two color pages and a second half of it comes, like, halfway through the chapter. I think they really stopped caring a lot after they had to basically, because they had it as a separate subscription, and then it just didn't have enough numbers, so they rolled it into the anime subscription, and I feel like at that point, that was the point I feel like that level of interest started dropping significantly.
Yeah, and I kind of wonder if it'll just go away completely because the licenses will be up and then they won't want to have to put more money into it.
Mm-hmm.
Although, like you said, they have added a few titles every once in a while. I mean, that Final Fantasy manga that I talked about, that's, you know, was new and on there, so I don't know. It just, again, doesn't feel as though they're really invested in it. So it is really sad, though, to see that all this is going away. And I think, thank goodness that Kodansha's digital program on stuff like Comixology is really great. And there's often sales and stuff like that. So if you're, you know, wanting to read more of this stuff, I think they've given you a really good opportunity to do that. So, and at least in most of that stuff, you can also still sample it before you read it. You just can't read tons and tons and tons of it.
Yeah, I do wonder if someone could make the manga a la carte that isn't, you know, a scanlation site work.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because I've seen, like, dozens of attempts, and none of them have really caught on like the anime sites have.
I think that both of us have gotten so used to using stuff like Crunchyroll that we forget that lots of people still don't.
Mm-hmm. But I feel like at least that seems like a fairly viable and, like, you know, I mean, we'll get into it, but it seems like other people are getting into the streaming anime market. So it seems like a market, but I feel like it is enough of a profit that people are looking into it. And the sites that you see generally seem to stick around, like Dasuke and that. The ones that the Americans run for Americans seem to do well. It's the ones that the Japanese run for Americans that seem to, like, crash and burn.
Fair. Yeah, I mean, if we're looking at these graphic novel sales numbers and we're looking at these manga sales numbers and they're really good for the U.S., then yeah, there seems as though you should be able to make it work. But then again, for the most part, no one's really figured out how to make an unlimited sort of streaming thing for books work.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, maybe, I have no idea, but I don't know the whole behind the scenes on that, but they haven't, you know, gotten it to work that way. And manga is a little bit more available if you have a library, you know, everybody has a library. Not everybody has, like, a library that has tons and tons and tons of manga, but it is available there, too. And it's free, I heard one time.
So they say. And my only other example is Crackle is still alive. It's still licensing anime every once in a while. And if that doesn't show that the anime and video streaming market is more robust, then I don't know what is.
All right, that's really fair. Speaking of manga and, you know, digital whatnot, so there was an announcement that Akita Publishing is releasing La Magnifique Grande, whatever. You know what? I can't speak Japanese. I can barely speak English. Don't expect me to speak French, people. But it's a ballet manga. And if I ever knew that this publisher existed, I had forgotten completely. Because they have released a dozen titles digitally on Comixology. Japanese company, you know, and the prices are really good. So you can get volumes for like $3.99 to $5.99 for an entire volume. And you can also read the first chapters for free, so you can check them out. But I really am super interested in this because I want more ballet manga. And I was surprised. Did you remember this company, Al?
No.
Okay. I just, not that we have the best memories, but I just didn't know. And then there's like crazy seinen ping pong manga. And most of their stuff seems to be sort of like romance. Mm. A lot of shoujo and jose romance stuff. But yeah, they're adding kind of a variety of things.
I do feel like Comixology has like a bunch of like hidden, oh, this is manga that's on Comixology that I've never heard of, but for some reason is here.
Exactly. So this is one of those times. So Akita Publishing, like I said, they have about a dozen titles. The ballet one sounds really good. There's one called Harem Days, which initially I was no, but then it's like a Chinese fantasy series. Looks kind of maybe like Sengoku-esque, which I know is totally mythical, but it has a similar looking feel, so possibly that would be good. Anyway, there's just the ability to try out some stuff that you've definitely never heard of and at a really good price. So now I do want to say that I haven't even had a chance to read a free chapter yet, so I'm not sure like how the translation is or how the format is, but it's just goes to show, I guess, that there really is a lot of a market for manga. So, and hopefully I will be talking about this ballet manga on the next podcast.
Excellent. As I mentioned, Netflix said that they were going to put all this, like, millions and millions of dollars into producing new anime for next year. And you're like, sure, whatever. I guess you're going to make, like, a Death Note movie and a few other things. And then this was just like, yeah, bitch, we're Netflix. Here's our stuff. Here are all these companies we're going to team up with and make anime with.
Yeah, it's... I'm not quite sure if this is just like an extension of them, you know, because they had already announced a couple of different things that they had in the works, and we saw them co-producing. But then this announcement came out sort of as if they were re-announcing that they were I don't know, it was kind of weird. I wasn't sure if it was different.
Well, it was really ambiguous, other than a few, like, marquee titles that they mentioned. This is a lot more definitive. We're going to work with these animation studios.
So we've got Production IG, we got Bones, we have Wit Studio, and the report says that, you know, one of, like, sort of the parent companies also owns Zybek and Signal MD, but those weren't called out specifically from Netflix, so unclear if those studios will also be working with them. I guess, like you said, Al, this is saying all these studios we're going to be doing stuff with. That doesn't mean there's nothing about exclusivity in this announcement, so it's not as if now all the anime that Production IG makes will only be available on Netflix, although I'm sure they would love that.
But I'm pretty sure the anime they specifically make with Production IG will only be on Netflix.
Of course. And I think that's very interesting, if only because, I mean, obviously we've seen like a big switch to digital for everything, but there's still a pretty significant physical market for anime because of the collectors. And so, you know, stuff that's available on Netflix is never available on a physical thing.
Unless it was like Netflix bought like a TV series that had like an earlier run or something like that. But yeah, anything that's like a Netflix original, and actually is a Netflix original, yes, does not ever seem to get physical release.
And even stuff that's not, but that they've commandeered, such as Little Witch Academia, there's no announced home video release for that, which I think is really unfortunate because I'd love to have it. So it's interesting that, and I think we're seeing that a little bit too with the Crunchyroll Funimation partnership, because the amount of physical titles that Funimation has like announced has dropped a lot from that, and then, you know, doing a lot more of just streaming stuff. So this just feels like it's gonna really continue down that path. And I'm trying not to buy as much anymore because I pay for all of these subscriptions to watch everything. So I understand that, but also I think there's that feeling of, well, if it's not streaming anymore, how do we watch it? You know? And I guess the concept is that Netflix will live on forever and ever until we're dead, at least. So it'll be fine, because if it's a Netflix original, they're clearly going to keep it on there because that's their whole model. So maybe it's fine. I don't know.
You know, it'll be well, once again, I think that's like the eternal dilemma of the modern digital audience of like, if I only have it digitally, you say that it lasts forever, but...
Well, I don't mind owning things digitally.
Well, I mean, like, when you own it, like, a subscription to a thing...
That's what I mean, yeah. Because I don't mind, oh, if I own something digitally. Again, I mean, yes, you could say, like, oh, if the service goes down, then how will you ever have it? Totally relevant argument, but I'm meaning in the case of a subscription, I don't have access to it. I have no control over whether or not it still exists. So that's I'm bringing back the old arguments, okay, for the old fogies.
So next up, Subversive.
Yes, that'll be the whole next podcast.
Excellent.
Unfortunately, they haven't announced any titles or...
length.
Yeah, and they haven't even said really when... again, they've already collaborated with some studios. They already have some stuff on Netflix right now that they've made collaborations with. But it's an interesting, vague statement that masquerades as an announcement when we still don't really have much to go on about, or you know, the concept of, well, how many shows are we talking about here? And if they're making Netflix originals, right, does that mean, say, less anime on TV in Japan? And then, or does this up how many anime we're gonna have in a season? I don't know. It makes me ask random vague questions of it. So, because if it's 10 shows, I mean, that's a lot of freaking anime. And then what are we talking about in terms of how does that affect, you know, Crunchyroll? The monsters are coming out. Like, the monsters with all the money, because no one understands how Netflix works, so they have unlimited money.
It's all invested in cryptocurrency, Kate.
I mean, probably, or they're interdimensional aliens, and they actually are pulling money from a different dimension, so it doesn't even matter. It doesn't even exist on this plane.
So they're the TCRI aliens from the original Ninja Turtles comic?
Absolutely. All right. I feel like any scenario at this point is a valid theory. Okay, and I just wanted to mention this new thing that is simulcasting. So normally if I watched something, I would talk about it in the ongoing investigation section. But this isn't, I don't know, it doesn't go there. And I only watched like one episode to get a feel for it. But Crunchyroll is now streaming Anisong Station. So it's not a variety show, but it's a show that highlights real-life musicians and anime singles and music videos, and it has a weekly ranking of the top anime songs. So, you know, anime, like, openings and endings mostly. Maybe, I guess, there could be some insert songs in there. Or, like, a song from a movie or something like that. It also has guests on. So they'll have, like, a special guest that maybe will perform. And then there'll also be random guests throughout that might come on and say their favorite three anime songs. And they're, like, a current, you know, new singer who's doing, like, a recent single or something like that. So it's not a variety show. It's a music show, I guess. It's MTV, but anime songs! There. It's just interesting that they have something like that.
You know what I found interesting that the article mentioned, just to prove that the Japanese music industry hasn't changed one bit? Most of the songs won't have subtitles. Because essentially, the only way that the songs can get subtitles is if the music company approves them. And, like, the article basically said that's not going to happen on most of them.
You don't need that.
I know, but it's just, it's more just, like, carryover from, like, why when I'm streaming the show, doesn't it have subtitles?
Oh, for the opening song.
Yeah, or the ending. Yeah, it's because the music company basically, sorry, we haven't had enough time to approve these lyrics, so we'll just never approve them.
So silly. I watched an episode, and I want to give a shout out that this week, it's number two song. And I also don't fully know how they figure out the rankings. Is it votes? Is it sales of singles? Is it a combination of other things?
Whoever pays the most.
Yeah, I mean, probably. But I'm just giving a shout out to the number two single for the week was the opening to Pop Team Epic. And when they show a clip from the song, sometimes it's if it has a music video from the singer, then that's what they show. But they also, if it doesn't, I guess they show the opening or the ending or whatever, because for Ancient Magus Bride the ending was on there and there wasn't a music video for it. So I just thought it was interesting.
So two questions, Kate.
Yeah.
One, was there, because Pop Team Epic was song number two, did they have a surprise announcement that they would never have Bob Team Epic ever again?
No, but did you see the Bob Team Epic with the live action where they were doing the sketchbooks? Because they actually did something good.
What?
I was blown away.
A good pop Bob Team Epic.
Yeah. They redeemed themselves.
Well, I guess a broken clock is right twice a day. Oh, and my second question is, since the Ancient Magus' Bride didn't have an accompanying music video, did they just play random clips that had nothing to do with the show, like at a karaoke joint where you're just like, what is this? Background animations and, like, clips have to do with the song.
No, since this is funded clearly by the music industry, they had money to actually show relevant animation.
Oh, man. So was it just like, well, why is this couple, like, going to the beach?
Yeah, no, that we didn't have to worry about that. It's a short show, so it's like a half hour, and I just thought it was interesting. I wanted to check it out, and I encourage other people to check it out just because it's sort of a look into something that I feel we don't really have a lot of access to. So I think it was very interesting that Crunchyroll added it to the site. And also because I personally don't interact with the Japanese live music scene a lot.
That you're not a otaku.
Yeah, I'm not, you know? And so I find it interesting, and I think other people might find it interesting. It's also sort of, like, you forget, I think, because of the way American music is now, that seriously every freaking song in Japan has a freaking music video of the, like, it's just, it's crazy how much just effort is put into, like, every single little aspect of everything for every single and every singer. And
have you ever seen the Ori-sama videos for Magical Circle Guru Guru? Oh, they're very amusing. Those neither here nor there, but I've seen, like, the actual singers. It's like a guy and a girl who do them, and they have their own, like, little animated versions of themselves and that are in the background while they tell the story of whatever music video they're in.
That wraps up another Speakeasy podcast. Remember to visit ReverseThieves.com for all kinds of content to tide you over until the next episode.
I'm just going to use this stinger space to make a quick correction that I don't think anyone cares about from one of our SWAT reviews. When we reviewed Record of Grand Crest War, I accidentally said that that was set in the same universe as Record of Lodoss War. With a little further research after that episode came out, I actually found out that Record of Grand Crest War is by the same company that puts out Sword World and Record of Lodoss War, but it's their next setting. If you're any kind of RPG player, it's like if Lodoss War is, you know, the World of Darkness with Vampire and Mage the Ascension, then Record of Grand Crest War is set in like the Exalted universe. Or if you want like a video game example, it's like if Lodoss War is Final Fantasy, then Grand Crest War is the Secret of Mana series. There you go. All right. For the one person who cared about that, there's a clarification.